the clean energy transition is about supporting the planet with clean sources plus supporting humans with the energy that they need. So that's the 10,000 foot view. And then the question becomes, and this is the question that every engineer asks, okay, great. How do we do that? Like, practically speaking, saying we're working on the clean energy transition sounds great for a politician, who's looking at that very top level, big patterns of motion. But the implementation of that, how do we actually get renewable sources of energy into the ground, integrated into the grid, making sure that the grid stays reliable, making sure that people get the electricity that they need, making sure it's not too expensive for everybody? How does that actually play out? How do we actually work to make that happen?
I'm George Siegel, and this is the Tell Us How to Make It Better podcast. Every week, we introduce you to people who are working on real-world problems and providing actual solutions. Tell Us How to Make It Better is partnering with The Readiness Lab, the home for podcasts, webinars, and training in the field of emergency and disaster services. Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining me on today's Tell Us How to Make It Better podcast. When you're in your house or your office and you flip on a light switch or turn the air conditioning down, turn the heat up, turn on the TV or the radio, do you ever think of all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes to make that happen? Well, my guest today has to do all of that. And not only that, she's working on systems that make the whole thing a lot more efficient. My guest today is Amy Simpkins, co-founder and CEO of MuGrid Analytics. Amy provides bankable techno-economic analysis, optimized control and project development of renewable energy, energy storage, and microgrids to maximize economic return, increase energy resilience, and promote energy equity in the U.S. and around the world. Amy is also the author of Spiral, a Catalyst for Innovation and Expansion, and host of the Power Flow podcast, which amplifies diverse voices in the clean energy revolution. Amy, welcome.
Thank you so much, George. Glad to be now, here.
Let's let the audience in. I had to ask you about the name right off the bat to expose just what a knucklehead I am. MuGrid. Explain what that is.
Definitely. So mu is the Greek letter mu, which I think most people, if you forgot your Greek alphabet from when you were in school or blocked that, most people heard of it. It was a COVID variant at one point. There was a mu variant of COVID. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it didn't turn out to be very bad. But
you would have had to change your name. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, Delta Airlines, right, got really nervous when, sure. When Delta. But anyway, so mu is the Greek letter mu. And in science and engineering, the Greek letter mu is used to stand for the prefix micro, like micrometers. We use that, the Greek letter, to signify. So we work on microgrids. And so our name is MuGrid. So it's kind of a engineering pun. And that's how we roll here at MuGrid.
I could picture the party with all the engineers sitting around the table laughing at all us less smart people, because the people that majored in engineering when I was in college were so much smarter than the rest of us. It was embarrassing, and they had to really work hard as opposed to the rest of us as well. Now, I also asked you, and I want to get into what you do, is I sort of understand it. I was intrigued by it. I thought you'd be a great guest once we drill down on exactly what you do. But a lot of this is very confusing. So let's get real simple here. What is the problem or issue that you are working on?
Sure. So let's start at like a 10,000 foot view and say, very simply, I'm working on the clean energy transition, right? I think we all know that, like, we have a climate change problem. Even people who were not convinced of that are starting to be convinced as we have more and more natural disasters, more and more severe weather events. Like, climate change is upon us, and we need to do something about it. There are many things we can do about it. One of the biggest things we can do is change how we consume and produce our electrical energy. And what's tricky about that is that electricity in our modern era has become super important. It's become, it's practically a human right. In order to function as a high functioning, developed, civilized society, we need to have access to electrical energy. And so the clean energy transition is really about finding the balance between energy generation that's good for the planet, so it's not producing tons of carbon emissions, that it's not producing tons of toxic wastes, but that's, it's also supporting humans, because humans need to have electrical energy, at least in this modern era. It really is a necessity. And so the clean energy transition is about supporting the planet with clean sources, plus supporting humans with the energy that they need. So that's the 10,000 foot view. And then the question becomes, and this is the question that every engineer asks, okay, great, how do we do that? Mm-hmm. Like, practically speaking, saying we're working on the clean energy transition sounds great for a politician, you know, who's looking at that very top level, big patterns of motion. But the implementation of that, how do we actually get renewable sources of energy into the ground, integrated into the grid, making sure that the grid stays reliable, making sure that people get the electricity that they need, making sure it's not too expensive for everybody? How does that actually play out? How do we actually work to make that happen? So there are many different areas of renewable energy deployment that people work in, that need help, that need innovation. The place where I am working, where my company MuGrid works, is in microgrids. So what's a microgrid? A microgrid is a collection of energy generation and storage assets. And we can talk about why you need to have both of those in a second. But it's a collection of energy generation, storage, and control that are together, and they're serving local loads. So instead of having a giant power plant that's located many, many miles away from your house, and you don't even know where your local power plant is located and where the electricity that comes to your house comes from, a microgrid is something that you could see. Like, it could serve your house, it could serve your neighborhood, it could serve your office building, it could serve your office park, but you know where the energy came from and it's serving the loads right there. And there are several benefits of that, which we can talk about more. One is, you know, less distribution and transmission architecture needed, which ends up having less risk of disruption, because there's just less stuff to disrupt along the way. It doesn't have a very far distance to travel. You can have cleaner sources because you can have the renewables like right there locally, less losses, more resilience, and we hope better economics. And so all of that comes into the equation. We're solving this kind of simultaneous equation of being more sustainable and green, getting our clients better deals on their energy in terms of economics, saving money on their utility bills, and providing resilience and backup power in the case that the grid goes down for whatever reason. And we've seen lots of grid disruptions of late due to weather events, natural disaster events. And also, you know, there's always security issues around sure. large grids. And so they're big problems that we can address one microgrid at a time in local immediate ways, which is actually really exciting, because it doesn't necessarily take a huge coordinated effort across many, many people and many, many jurisdictions and who is the ultimate decision authority, because it's a microgrid and it's locally developed and controlled. It's actually easier to make it happen.
So how do you, for example, I used to have something called Roadrunner high-speed internet years ago. And the problem with that was when all my neighbors were on as well, it slowed down dramatically. So if you have a microgrid in a neighborhood and you have some high consumer family of 20 that is blasting away their air conditioning at 65 degrees, how does that affect everybody else in the area? Is the system smart enough so it can really break it down and people get what they need?
That is such a good question in so many ways, because we often look, the energy industry is looking at the telecom industry as kind of a case study of how technology has developed, advanced, and proliferated, and how we can learn some of those lessons and make different choices. So the first thing I'll say is that the situation that we're describing, and I know I said it, that it could be on the neighborhood level. Most microgrids are not covering a whole neighborhood right now. There are some policy, regulatory, legal issues. It's, you know, it's not necessarily the technology issue. There are some like contractual issues of why that doesn't happen right now. That's not to say it won't happen in the future. And I'll come back to your actual question in a minute. Most microgrids today are working at, let's say, a building's level. And so your question is still good because there is definitely a direct relationship between how much generation and storage you have available and what the load on your site is doing. And as I will say, definitely Americans and probably Westerners in general, we are very, very used to just flipping our light switch and the power comes on and we don't think about it ever. We don't think about charging our electric vehicle and running our well pump for our water and running the microwave and the air conditioning all at the same time, because we don't have to think about it. The history of our electrical grid, particularly in this country and in most Western developed countries, is that the entire reason for being of the grid is to keep the lights on no matter what, and to make sure that you have as much load as you need available no matter what, at any time. You can turn any piece of equipment on at any time and have the power. And that is how our grid has been designed. As you might imagine, there's some major inefficiencies in that approach. Is it convenient for us all? Yes, it's very convenient. And we've all been lulled into the sense of like this high reliability situation where we don't have to think about it. But as we transition into clean energy, we're going to have to start thinking about it more and more. And some of it is the humans need to think about it and just have an awareness of what's happening. But mostly we're introducing more and more computer controls. And this is already happening at the building level. In a lot of commercial buildings, you'll have what's called a building management system. And we see it in like programmable thermostats. That's a really good example of a really just first level tech that's available to everyone, commercial buildings, residential buildings. Most people I know have a programmable thermostat now where you can set at least baseline windows of like, okay, when it's at night, I don't need it to be 72 degrees in here. It can go down to 60. You know, while I'm away at work, I don't need to set the air conditioning to 68. I can leave it at 82. And then, a half an hour before I get home from work, I'm going to tell the air conditioning to come on so that it's comfortable when I get home. That's efficient. Not only is it helping you be comfortable, but it's helping you be more energy efficient. And so those sorts of controls, which are computerized, we're going to see that develop more and more in anticipating loads, in reacting to current loads, bringing generation online. And those sorts of controls are getting more and more sophisticated. So back to your original question, which was at the neighborhood level, balancing demand, that's what we call that when you have, in your telecom example, when you get home from work and you sign in to check your email and it's super slow because six of your neighbors are watching Netflix, that's because the demand for bandwidth is higher. And so the analog in electricity is the same thing, that when everyone is running their air conditioning plus their EV charging plus their microwaves all at the same time, the demand is high. And in the past, it has been the grid's job, your local utility, part of their job and why you're paying them is to balance that and saying, there is the demand is coming up. We need to bring some more generation online. That's what the grid does. That's why it's a great service. That's why we pay them. And there's sometimes I think people have this antagonistic relationship with the utilities where they're like, oh, like it's punitive. They're charging us so much money. What are they actually doing there?
Exactly.
It's just a money grab. It's not. I mean, I respectfully, and there's, sure, are there greedy people everywhere? Yes, there are greedy people everywhere. But really, I mean, the grid is providing such a valuable service that we don't have to think about. All of this stability, all of this demand balancing is done by them, which is why we pay for it, pay the big bucks. And as generation becomes localized, someone is going to have to make that decision. It's probably going to be a local controller that is a computer. And behind that computer, there may be a human sitting at a console somewhere that is paid some small subscription fee to monitor the situation. But the first question you asked was a really great question about innovation that is currently happening and needs to continue to happen in the industry and is not completely solved.
Well, what we do see is whenever we do need them to make decisions, and this is why a lot of people don't like their utility company, it tends to be at a bad time, like in Texas last year with the ice storms. And then when it gets really hot in some places and they do rolling brownouts where they have to cut people. So you don't really, like you say, you don't really think about it till you have to. And then once you have to think about it, it's usually not a good experience.
Totally. Absolutely.
So I wouldn't want to be their crisis management person by any stretch of the imagination. So how do you set these things up then? If it's not neighborhood level, where are you implementing what you're doing and what kind of success are you having with it? How's it making things better?
Yeah, great. So most of our microgrids these days are, like I said, at a building's level. And so think about a building that may be some sort of critical infrastructure that's serving the community needs and that would need to have like resilient backup power. And so we see health clinics or hospitals. Hospitals already have backup power requirements. So they often have massive generators sitting out back because it's life-saving. And hospitals are starting to see like, hey, we can integrate with those fossil fuel-based generators. We can integrate some renewables, some energy storage, save money when the grid is up and have cleaner backup. So that's happening. Other facilities, I mean, the pandemic, especially around lockdown times, really showed us what was critical infrastructure. Like, of course, we know that like fire stations are critical and 911 call centers, those are critical, but grocery stores, also critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And until the fossil fuel to electric vehicle transition, gas stations, also critical infrastructure, you know, and so really determining, you know, those are places that may not have previously said, oh yeah, we need to have like very reliable backup power. And now I think there's a recognition that the definition of critical infrastructure is bigger than it used to be. And so we'll take a commercial building like a grocery store or a medical clinic or a community center. Community centers are also great facilities because they often have facilities that can serve in emergencies like showers, commercial kitchens that can prepare food and refrigerators and things like that. And the other thing about this type of building is they're on commercial rate tariffs. And the thing about commercial rate tariffs, so I'm over to the economic side now. Commercial buildings pay for electricity on slightly different structures than residential. Most residential rate tariffs are very, very simple. It's you just take the amount of kilowatt hours that you use, which is the total amount of energy, and you multiply that by a certain number of cents, depending on where you live, and that's your bill. That's it. Commercial rate tariffs get more complicated. At the very, very least, commercial rate tariffs pay for their energy, similar to your residential tariff, but then you also pay for your total demand, which means at some point in the month, you had that maximum, you were charging your electric vehicle and you were running the microwave and the air conditioning and your industrial equipment all at the same time. And your usage, the power that you were using went way up right in that moment. Even if you didn't use that much energy for the rest of the month, right in that moment, you used a lot. And as we discussed, the utility has to be able to serve that. And so commercial buildings pay what's called a demand charge on that peak of the month. And even just that extra complication means there's more economic opportunity to save money on your utility bills by having your own on-site assets. And so we're doing analysis for these buildings to say, how much energy are you going to offset and how much can you take that demand charge down? And here's how much we think you can save, which is why you can justify putting in these these energy assets, not to mention that the backup power is worthwhile to you. Now, that energy plus demand charge is the simplest commercial rate tariff. They actually get a lot more complicated. And the more complicated the rate environment, the more opportunity there is to take advantage of those rules and to play by their rules. I'll give you a quick example. And this is not a commercial. This is residential. I'm going to put it in residential terms because I don't know, most of the listeners, everyone who's listening pays residential rate, you know, electricity rates. Some people who are listening also pay commercial rates, but if they're in charge of that, but you definitely pay your residential rate. So here at my house, we have now gone to a rate structure called time of use. So we're not charged on demand. It's only on energy, but we used to pay 12 cents flat for every kilowatt hour we used at my house. But last year they changed us to a time of use rate, which means that when the system is peaking, when the utility expects to have that peak demand, they want us to use less if we can. It will help them out. It will cost them less money. And so to incentivize us to not use energy during that time, from 4 to 8 p.m., our electricity rate is now 30 cents instead of 12. But for the rest of the time, from 8 p.m. then around to 4 p.m. the next day, our utility rate, our energy rate is now 7 cents instead of 12. And so what we have done for the utility, because we're nerds over here at this house, is that you can actually hear our house go down at 4 p.m. We have put controllers on every piece of major equipment, including our well pump that pumps our water. We live kind of slightly rural, so we have a well. And so our well pump does not pump water between 4 and 8 p.m. And like we shut off all, like, every non-essential computing equipment shuts off at 4 p.m. We don't charge the electric vehicle from 4 to 8 p.m. And we have basically moved, I think our last bill I calculated, 95% of our electric usage is in the off-peak timeframe. Only 5% of our energy, total energy usage here at the house gets used between 4 and 8 p.m. And you could say, oh, wow, that 30 cents, that sounds punitive. Like that's the utility being aggressive towards you. And it's like, no, it's incentivizing my behavior. And I should be doing exactly what they want. They want to have less demand during 4 to 8 p.m. and I am giving them less demand. And if they're not happy with that, if they're like, but I'm losing revenue, then they structured the rate tariff improperly, because the rate tariff should incentivize the behavior they want to see.
You're a lot kinder towards them than I might be. We had these smart meters put in our houses that was supposed to make, you know, easier to keep track of everything. But in Florida, where I live, the utilities are skyrocketing now, and they're saying some people could see upwards of $100 a month increase in their bills, which makes what you're saying even more important, obviously, if we can find a way to work with that. But it really seems to work against us. Is all the problems happening in the world, it's more in the oil and gas. Does that spill over to electrical? Are the two problems intertwined in a way?
Oh, they're completely intertwined, because the majority of the generation on our grid is still fossil fuel based. I think it has shifted to majority, and I could look this up, but real quick, but it has shifted to majority natural gas. It used to be majority coal. There is still a significant portion that is coal. There's also a significant portion coming from like utility scale solar and utility scale wind, but it's not a majority. And so yes, our electricity costs are tightly correlated to fossil fuel prices of natural gas, oil, and coal.
So in a time like this, it probably makes it hard for us to be waving the flag saying we need to be more green in some areas, when what we really need to do is become completely free of having to buy oil and gas from foreign countries right now, especially Russia. Doesn't that, I mean, it kind of makes your job more challenging in a way, because there are the two kind of conflicting points. If we start producing more, I think some people are going to have a fit, yet we kind of have to, or we're going to be held hostage and see our rates go skyrocketing.
There's a couple things. The first disclaimer I'll give is that the transition from fossil fuels over to more to cleaner sources of energy is always going to be quite a gradual process. And it's never going to be like, oh my gosh, one day it's all coal and natural gas. And the next day it's all green energy. Like, it's never going to be like that. Think of the transition between like the horse and carriage to the automobile, right? It was a slow fade. As automobiles became more affordable and, you know, started to penetrate into different markets. So anything I'm saying about the transition, there's never going to be this like demarcation line of like, today is the day that we are all green. What you're saying, it's interesting. So from my perspective, and I will fully admit that I am not a oil and gas market expert, although I have a certain knowledge of it because of being in the electricity field. But the global oil and gas market is really linked. And so saying like, oh, well, foreign prices of oil and gas are going up, so we need to produce more at home in order to offset that is a little bit misguided. Like, the whole market is going to go the way it goes, and domestic prices will go up too, not just foreign prices.
I'm not talking about their prices. I'm talking about buying it from them at all. Do we want to rely on anybody but ourselves as a country? And then we can't be held hostage. I mean, I find it offensive that we're spending any money with Russia right now buying gas. I mean, that's not what we're talking about today. So I don't want to get off on a whole rant about that. but the fact is, we're supporting that terrorist regime by spending any money with them. And so I'm just saying this country needs to be more independent, which makes what you're saying probably more valuable.
Well, and I think it is related. I mean, the political climate is certainly related, and the political backing of, and as much as I give credit to the utilities and say, I've been known to say, your utility just wants you to be happy. Your utility just wants you to be happy and not call them and be upset about your service. That's, and I do believe that, but I also believe there's a lot of corruption in the traditional energy industries. And so it is a worthwhile conversation. And yes, I think there's a question of getting off of foreign, you know, independent of foreign sources. But let's be honest, most decisions can be quantified by looking at the economics of the situation. And we want to do the right thing, but even if we do want to do the right thing, the way that we quantify benefits are through economics. And so when I take a look at like the oil and gas market, whether that's the global market or the domestic market, which I believe are very, very, very correlated, if not, I almost want to say the same, although that would be gross exaggeration. You know, it is worthwhile thinking about the economics. What you said was, we want to be getting off foreign sources, and so that makes my job harder. And I would argue it actually makes it easier. And it's unfortunate that the way we are going to get more green energy in our systems, whether that's at the microgrid local level or at the utility scale larger grid level, is that it has to be more economic than the alternative. And unfortunately, what that means is the prices of fossil fuels need to go up in order to make it more viable. Can the prices of renewables come down? Yes, that's happening. It has happened. But also at the same time, there's going to be a discomfort caused by the cost of fossil fuels, regardless of source. And that's going to facilitate this transition. And I'm not saying we jack up the prices unnecessarily, but it's happening. Costs of fossil fuels are skyrocketing. You are going to see that reflected in electricity costs, and electricity utilities and producers are going to look for other sources. And that is actually a good thing. The discomfort will motivate the change that we need to see. Otherwise, it's just too comfortable to say like, yeah, solar's nice and I want to save the planet, but coal is cheap, man. Like, you know, and so it's through this combination of economic forces on the market and regulatory forces that say, no, you can't dump that amount of CO2 into the atmosphere. that's the combination of forces that motivates the change. And so the same change is happening in Europe as well. In some places, it depends on where you are in Europe. Of course, it's not a monolith, but in some places, Europe is ahead of where we are in terms of the green transition. But they're still obviously very, very dependent on fossil fuel. And unlike us, most of their sources are coming from, say, Russia. And so, we have to look at this as a global problem, which is really, it's really interesting for someone like me who works on microgrids, which are super hyper localized, right? We're talking about one building or two buildings, but we also have to keep that global perspective that it's all linked and we're all in this together, trying to figure out the way forward.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think in the foreseeable future, it's going to continue to just be a mess in terms of where we're getting our energy from. So what's the biggest obstacle that you face in what you do? What would you say is your biggest challenge?
That's a good question. So I'm gonna focus on like the microgrid piece specifically, not clean energy in general, because depending on where you are in clean energy, there's different answers to that question. But when we're talking about microgrids, it's really the economics of systems. The cost of the equipment has come down sufficiently to make it kind of break even. We're still getting used to the idea of how do we make or save money. Like when it used to be, rooftop solar has been around for, the pioneers of rooftop solar were really installing it in like the late 70s, and it has grown and become more and more mainstream. But solar has only really come into its own and become very, very widespread in the past 10 to 15 years. And so previously, the economics of solar were very simplistic and perhaps not super efficient. And there wasn't necessarily enough solar on the grid for the utilities to notice that the energy was only generated when the sun was out. And then when the sun was down, the customers needed to come back to the grid and increase their demand. And it didn't matter because there just weren't that many customers who were purchasing solar. But now it is in the state of California, where you have tremendously high solar penetration and regulations in place that are stating that no new construction in California can take place unless they include solar. And they're now passing regulation that say no new solar can go in without battery storage alongside it. And the reason for that particular regulation is that because there is such high solar penetration in California, there is a massive swing up to 15 gigawatts between like 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. as the sun goes down. And everyone who is running off of solar now has to come purchase the grid. And, we talked about demand, how the utility needs to cover that demand, and you can switch on your equipment at any time. And so what you're seeing there happening in that state is that effectively, as the solar power rolls offline, simply because the sun is going down, it's the effective result that everyone in the state is switching on all of their equipment all at the same time for the grid. And so that's why the state is now saying all new solar installations in California need to have a battery with them so that they can mitigate that, so that they can move the solar energy from when the sun is out to when it's not out. They can smooth out that massive swing of demand. So the biggest challenge is that I got off track there. That was a rabbit hole. I do that. No, you asked about the biggest challenge to microgrids, and it's really the economics. So the economics of solar in the past 10 to 15 years has been fairly simple and with not a lot of curbs on it. Mm-hmm. And it's as we see more and more penetration, not just of renewables, but also the introduction of controllable assets like energy storage, which for the most part are batteries, but there's other energy storage technologies as well. But once you have storage, you have decisions to make. When you have just solar or just wind, the electricity comes when it comes and you have no control over that. Once you put storage there, there's control. In fact, a battery doesn't do anything unless you tell it to do it. Unlike, you know, solar, you put it out there and the electrons flow and everything happens. It's sort of automatic. With a battery, if you don't tell it to do something, and by you, I mean a computer, it doesn't do anything. It just sits there. We have had actually a client who came to us who said, we installed a battery 6 months ago. It hasn't done anything. And we said, what kind of controller do you have with it? And they said, we needed a controller.
Yeah.
And so making those decisions, again, like I said, about the kind of the whole market picture, those decisions are generally economically driven. And we use the market to influence our behavior. When is it most beneficial to use this energy? The market will tell us by the pricing. And so that is the new problem. And you said it's a mess right now. And it does feel like a mess because we are in a period of very rapid and disruptive innovation. And disruptive innovation always feels like mess. And this is my other side passion, is an innovation theory, how innovation happens. It will always feel like chaos, especially when you're looking at this like massive industry that has been stable for over 100 years and affects nearly every person on the planet. It's going to feel like mess. The economics that justify microgrids aren't stellar yet. And there's a few different factors that could help that in the future. One is fossil fuel prices increasing, whether that's naturally on their own due to global climates or regulatory like taxes or penalties because of carbon emissions. The cost of energy technology coming down, a lot of clean energy technology, specifically around storage and controls, is nascent. It's very young, it's quite immature, and that means the prices are still pretty high. And not just the prices of the technology, but also the prices to install the technology. Like getting an engineer to sit down and design the system, it's a unique, very highly creative process every time. Nothing about it is standardized, and the costs reflect that. And then the other third piece of that, so we've got fossil fuel costs going up, clean energy costs coming down, and the third piece of the economic picture is that rate tariff environment. We're in a time of transition where utilities and customers are asking, why do we pay for electricity this way? Is there a better way to do it? Can it be more efficient? Can it get us better outcomes instead of just saying, yeah, we can supply as much demand as you want at any time, and we're going to have these giant standby generators over here that barely ever get used and cost $1 million to run? Is there a better way? There's probably a better way. Let's think about that. Let's re-architect that. And then we're seeing these rate tariff changes. Like time of use is coming to residential. I promise you, demand charges are going to come to residential too.
It's already here.
It's already here. And so how do we educate consumers to adjust their behaviors in a way that's not intrusive on your life? You know, how do we introduce new technologies like building controllers or in-house controllers to help you manage without having to think so hard about it? And how do we introduce local generation and storage to take advantage of those? And so that economic picture, as you've pointed out, and as you can tell from the story, is fairly chaotic and complex. And a lot of the technology around the controls to manage all of that are also nascent and in the middle of a big innovative transition.
Well, you've gone from confusing me to really confusing me, which is very easy to do. So if there's somebody out there that has an idea or a thought, something that a creation they want to come up with, or they've been thinking about, what advice would you have to somebody who wants to be a problem solver, but they're just not getting in there and doing it? What would you say to give them a little push?
In general,
just advice for somebody who, I think. I have an idea that could help, but I don't know how to do anything with it. You know, a lot of people want to do something, but they're, for whatever reason, they hold themselves back.
Oh gosh, I have a million things to say because
we don't have time for a million of them. go to the best one.
Okay. Go to the best one. Okay. Well, so the first thing I want to just say to you, friend, with an idea, is that you, if you're like me and you're an idea person, you probably have a lot of ideas. And one of the biggest lessons in my personal life has been, I could do anything that I want, but I can't do everything. And so I think my first and greatest and best thing is focus. To pick, if you have a thing and you're passionate about it and you want to work on it, dive into it and then, and don't worry about some of the other stuff. This is all connected. You know, we haven't even gotten to one of the things in my intro was talking about energy equity, which means serving populations that traditionally got left behind, including Native Americans and low income neighborhoods and immigrant neighborhoods that get left behind when it comes to new technologies like clean energy. And some of them stand to benefit the most from these types of technologies. And it's like, I care about equity as a person, but I'm not actively working in an equity role. However, working in clean energy touches equity, and I can make a difference in equity by staying in my lane in clean energy. And so that focus is important. Dive in with both feet by helping with any issue. By helping with equity, you are helping the clean energy transition, if that's your lane. By helping in clean energy, you are helping with equity. That is, you know, it's all interconnected. And this is what we're going to see more and more is the breaking down of stovepipes, that as we solve for solutions that benefit all and benefit the planet, we start to have to look across boundaries. And so to give them the push, what can I say to give them the push? Your idea is important. The only way that we move forward as society, the only way we save this beautiful planet, the only way we find peace, I know this sounds really like high goals, is with your ideas. Like, every person needs to be engaged. And if you have a focus and if you have a lane, you get to influence all of the rest. I recently, in one of my own podcast interviews, I had a guest who said, we're all rowing in the same direction. So I want to encourage you above all to grab that oar. If you have that idea, grab that oar and come join us. And we're all rowing in the same direction of people and planet. And the more people who are rowing in that direction, the faster we make positive change.
All right. Great answer. Amy, how do people get in touch with you? How do they follow you, find out what, if they want to reach out to you?
The best place to find me is LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and I often post both microgrid energy nerdiness and also just clean energy in general from my own podcast. And so LinkedIn has my contact information, and you can find me there.
All right. I'll put all the links to your podcast and to LinkedIn will be in the show notes, so people will be able to find you. Amy, thank you so much for coming on today. And like I said, a lot of this is confusing to me, but I do follow you on LinkedIn, and I'm going to try to understand this stuff better, but it's fascinating stuff.
Awesome. Well, I would leave the audience, I guess, by saying that we all touch energy. And that was one, you know, my background, we didn't talk about it. My background is in aerospace and spacecraft design. And that's pretty far out there, literally, for a lot of people. Not a lot of people interact with a spacecraft in their lifetime, but everybody interacts with energy, electricity, heat, we all need it. And so even if it feels hard to understand, it's one of the single best things you can do as an individual, as a private citizen, is just raise your awareness of how you're using energy. And don't say that's too complicated for me, because you're part of this system.
Well, it's going to encourage me to try to figure it out. So I appreciate it. Thanks again for coming on.
Awesome. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you for joining me on today's Tell Us How to Make a Better podcast. If you liked what you were listening to, please share the link with your friends so they can become listeners as well. Subscribe so you can listen on a weekly basis. Leave a review. And you can also go to our website, tellushowtomakeitbetter.com, and give some suggestions for future guests or comments about what you were just listening to. Thanks again for your time today. We'll see you next time.